kcomicsbeat.com and kcomicsbeat@kcomicsbeat.com, and also a contributing editor to Publishers Weekly. And you can find us on social media at PW Comics World, on Twitter at Blue Sky at PW Comics World dot social dot sky.
I'm Meg Lemke. I'm the graphic novels reviews editor at Publishers Weekly. We're also on Instagram. The best way to find us is to put the search bar Publishers Weekly, and then you'll find it. That's how
My
we do it every time.
name's Kate Fitzsimmons, and you can find us online at tumblr.com/PWComicsWorld. And also, you can find us on publishersweekly.com/comics.
Yes, and in case you can't figure it out, Calvin is not here this week, so we have Meg in as a special guest. This week on More to Come, where Meg and Kate and I are going to talk about ALA, and then we're also going to talk about well, The Week in Diamond, as always, ongoing saga. What is going on at Silver Sprocket, and also rest in peace, Jim Shooter. So. And also, by the way, you can find us sometimes on some podcast platforms. And if you wish to, you can also leave us a comment if you can possibly find our podcast on those platforms. Yes, listeners, we're still working on some technical issues, but we are working tirelessly, ceaselessly around the clock, and someday it's all going to be fixed. So Meg and I were just returned from sweaty Philadelphia for the American Library Association. Calvin is on vacation this week. Now, Kate, you just came back from vacation. And before we get into ALI, I got to ask you, you were in Venice, Italy, and so were some other people, I understand.
Yeah, so my parents were like, "Hey, why don't you join us on vacation this summer?" And I was like, "Sure." And then Jeff Bezos announced he was going to get married at the same time, at the same place that we were going to be on vacation. Yeah. And the Venetians were not in a good mood. I mean, not that they were impolite to like tourists, but they were just sort of like genuinely, we were in a different part of Italy for part of the trip, and then we were in Venice, and I don't think I was imagining it that there was definitely, like, compared to other Italians around tourists in 2025, there was a certain air of put upon annoyance. I didn't see any famous people. I did see an awful lot of really big yachts. And so, yeah, it was a strange experience. Like every time you turned a corner, you were like, am I going to see like a famous person? It was just a surreal experience. It was very surreal.
Yeah, so I mean that's sad. I wish you'd see Tom Brady and Orlando Bloom trying to pick up girls or something. I mean that would have been fun, but yeah. So I mean that's sad. I wish you'd see Tom Brady and Orlando Bloom trying to pick up girls or something. I mean that would have been fun, but
Safely got across this long stage. So he was on the outside facing the audience, and he was doing the hands. I'm doing it on, this is a audio
Yeah.
meeting that you all
Yes,
know.
she's telling us
The
to live
Vulcan
long and
salute, yes.
prosper. Welcome salute. So he's doing that on the outside, like the librarians are crying, like everybody's like freaking out, and I'm just like holding this gentleman's arm and dying inside. It was a very like Lee, his editor, said it was going to have a real like walking down the aisle feel generationally, which he is about. My father's was older when I was born, and my father is in his 80s, and so it was actually very moving to me on a personal level. Oh.
But like it yeah.
He is such an inspiring figure, and I've heard from many people that they're just so incredibly moved when they meet him and interact with him, and just his life story and everything he represents is so powerful. And you listen, Meg, I'll say from the I was a little mortified because we were sitting in the front row because we were in the press reserve seats, and I did feel a little
In
I never
the
sit in the
line of
front row.
sight. I didn't see you though, which
Yeah.
is good because
Okay. Phew.
I just tried to look at George, which was
Yes,
nice.
yes.
I was
Well,
like,
you did a listen. I just want to say you did a great job. And really you did a really wonderful job up there and talking to a legend and which listen, I mean he does ramble. Okay.
Of
And he
course,
admits, yes, he's an
older.
88-year-old man with tons and tons of stories. So, he rambles about it. And you did
He
a
says
community.
that. He said on the stage, "Oh, I know I go on." So part of the, I mean, it's like I'm being told to interrupt this legend. And you know what? You all, we want to talk about my experience at LA, but also, as of now, he said he's going to try and come on the podcast. Oh my God.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
I am crossing fingers. I don't want to overpromise more to
But
come with.
if it does come true, that would be amazing. Yes.
So then you'll hear me again trying to interrupt the 88-year-old man who is incredibly thoughtful, talking about an incredibly difficult childhood, and then being like, "Okay, George, let's just get back to the current book," which is like,
Well, the
but he did. He came around, and he has such great one-liners. He gets up there and calls the current administration Vulcans, which is quite
No,
funny.
he calls them
Oh,
Klingons.
Klingons. I'm sorry, I meant Klingons.
Oh boy. Woo.
No, not Vulcans, Klingons. But actually,
Yes.
someone else said the Klingons in later, whatever. Like that was
Yeah.
critiqued by the
Well, there
D.
was, well, Bridget
Couple.
Alverson, who was my roommate and traveling companion for the show, also a casual PW contributor. She had tweeted that, or blue skied it, pardon me, posted it, and she says her mentions went out of control because people were saying, Klingons were rehab, they weren't all bad, maybe he was more like a this or that, talking about the current administration. So
But I think it's like that's George's era of Trek.
Yes, Klingons
And
were bad in Mr.
yeah.
Sulu's time. Yes, we
Yeah,
know
Mr.
that.
Sulu's
Yeah,
time.
and I think it's fair to say that there are plenty of Klingons who are not good, and the Yes.
flavor of bad they might be different than other cultures' flavor of bad in Star Trek.
Good
Point, Kate. I also think that it bears repeating, as I've said a few times, and if you come to this book, it rhymes with decay because you want to know about Star Trek. There's like 10 pages of a 300-page book that are about Star Trek. There's as many pages or more about his other work in the theater, both the first theatrical production he was in called Fly Blackbird, which was like a civil rights era multicultural cast, and then his recent Broadway show Allegiance, which is about the story of a family who go through Japanese American incarceration in the camps in the World War II and a reckoning around it. Like he is. There's stuff in there that will be super fun for Trekkies, but it's really also for like transit nerds. Like at you know, like it's it
And
teaches a lot about transit advocacy, which is fascinating.
I that was the part that really fascinated me, to be honest. It was talking about how he worked with Mayor Tom Bradley of Los Angeles about, to promote Los Angeles mass transit, which, having lived in LA, you definitely need.
He should get on the Rail Natter podcast. He should, and he loved to talk about it. Like we even on at ALA, that was like our biggest laugh was that he was talking about the Philly transit. Like every city he goes to, I think he has been there to research their mass transit, so he can like rattle it off. And he cared. This is something that I started to try to articulate there, and I think it's really interesting. A lot of the reasons he stayed in the closet weren't just about like the fundamental trauma of his experience being seen as different and literally incarcerated for years as a child. So that created like a very strong sense of remaining hidden, but also about having become a part of Bradley's administration and the fear of taking down this like first black way if he was outed, and also like potentially harming the career of others with start like and you can really see how I think now people do not understand the very real threat to people's careers and like associated careers of the period. And he articulates it really well in the work, even if a lot of the work is him reckoning with that in retrospect, because when he did come out in terms of the timing, he had a whole second career that a lot of his contemporaries didn't, right?
And I mean, listen, we're lucky to have George Takei. And he, just what an extraordinary life, an extraordinary man. And Meg, I'm really glad you had that experience to get to interact with him and do that really great panel.
Thank you. It was a joy. And the librarians lined up for hours. He was a big hit at
Oh
the.
yeah. Now let's talk.
And I would say, just to promote the book, one last thing. The fact that there's only 10 pages of Star Trek should not necessarily be a negative for Star Trek fans, because, like, guys, you already know the Star Trek stuff. This is a chance to get
Good
to know
call.
him better.
Yes. Very well put.
Is juicy. There's some, like, he has a few axes to grind. He has a few reveals. There's some good Star Trek stuff. But yeah, let's talk about the rest of the show. It was hot.
So I just, obviously, as you know, the last time I went to ALA was 2019, just before the pandemic, and it was happiness, and Graphic Novel Roundtable had just been Graphic Novels and Comics Roundtable had just been founded, and it was good times. Librarians were our heroes, and now, unfortunately, 6 years later, I didn't get this note because I didn't really read my email, but apparently there was an advisory that not to wear your badge when you went outside, just in case there was anti-library sentiment. And so there was very much, unfortunately, an underlying tone of the fact that free speech and reading and libraries are under attack. We addressed some of this actually on an extra episode of More to Come, with where I talked to Jeff Trexler of the CBLDF, and I direct you to that because Jeff had some really interesting things to say.
I don't want to call more attention to it, but actually, yes, a picture of me and Mr. Takei was retweeted by someone who is an anti-library obsessive activist. And I don't think they know who I was, but they come after certain members of the GNCRT over and over again with like a complete, fixation. And these are people who've
So,
dedicated their lives to service,
yeah.
and
So, do they want to abolish libraries, or do they just want to control what's in them?
I mean, they're acting to abolish libraries at the federal level and the local level. They want to, I think they want an uninformed public. And they're also just caught up in this obsession with the idea that making literature that has queer voices and people of color available is indoctrination of children. It's like
Yeah, which is just absurd.
absurd.
And
It's absurd and
we
obsessive.
know that, but it's, I was going to say, though, like, despite this kind of underlying, note of sadness, there was a lot of fun times at ALA, and the spirit of reading and the spirit of librarianship, of course, did come out. And there was some other, like, so my one complaint about ALA is that it's so freaking hard to find out what's going on. And yet, librarians are super duper organized, and they do have all these meetings. There were so many panels, so many things, and this and that. And so they were like, oh, go to the app and download the app. So I did download the app, and then in order to get to the schedule on the app, you have to put in your membership number,
Oh, for
which is
Pete's sakes.
buried in my emails, which I mean, I have so many emails. I can't even get them on my phone. So I literally couldn't get the app until like the second day I was there. And then it was actually really great app, but it's
That's unnecessarily like a lot of conventions, like they'll let you see the program even if you aren't going there. Like, what's the
Well, it's
purpose
on the
in?
website, but there was so much to cover. So I would, but I think what, like, there was the graphic novel. It's not called the Pavilion, but there was an area, there was a stage that had constant graphic novel programming.
The graphic novel and gaming stage, but then
Yes.
there was comics programming on the Book Buzz panel, on other
Yes. It
panels.
was everywhere. It
Art
was
station.
fully integrated into every aspect of ALA. And that was really exciting. And I think the note for me that really struck me was just how many of the superstars of graphic novels were all there. Like Raina Telgemeier was there. She was only there for a very brief while, but she was there. Ngozi Okazu was there. Maya Kobe was there. Jerry Craft was there. I ran into him walking around. Jean Yang was there. Kind of like this murderer's row of the greats, the best sellers. I mean, these are really successful, award-winning, best-selling authors, and just kind of having them in one place was kind of inspiring for me.
Definitely. One thing I love about ALA, it's one of my favorite conferences. I was so glad to be back, is it's part of a larger book conference. Like, so, it's about book publishing in general and the community of librarians and the commitment to librarians for publishing. And there's reasons why those big names were brought out there by their publishers, which
Oh,
is that
yeah.
any individual librarian could have enormous outsize impact on the success
Well,
of the
right. And that was the other thing. I had this conversation with a few people, is that, BEA, Book Expo America, which was the trade show for publishing, which is where all the publishers went, booksellers went, some librarians. Just people who buy books to sell to the public used to go. That show is no more. And I mean, I know PW has tried to resurrect, has a smaller version of it, the US Book Show, but it is not a big show at the Javits
Not the
that,
same thing, is
because
it?
PRH won't buy a booth. Nobody wants to buy a booth at BEA anymore. And yet the ALA was huge. Like the Philadelphia Convention Center is a very large convention center, and it took up the whole exhibit floor. And there are library facing machines that do sorting. I don't even know what they do. I will say they had the best giveaways. This was a great show for giveaways.
You know what
Water.
they call the first night, Heidi? They call the very the opening preview night the running of the librarians. Like the running of the bulls. And they give away all the booths, give away so much. And when we were there with the French, I was there the first night. I actually opted out this because I was like, I didn't want to be trampled and gored. And they come out with bags and bags and bags and bags and bags and bags. And like it is a lot. There's definitely men in the librarian and of all genders in the librarianship, but it's a lot of ladies in cardigans and dresses. And then they're like wearing their sensible shoes and they have like these huge bags and they just take so much stuff. And there are some booths that sell and some things sell things, but most stuff is giveaways. And you'll see like all the Takei books were given away because, like just to break it down for our listeners. A librarian who has a buying, who has a collection ability, who has the power to make a purchase, might be making a purchase for a whole system, like a whole citywide system. And many librarians, especially if they go to ALA, so it's not like every librarian takes the effort and ambition to go to a national conference to like work through their system and get sponsored or whatever, or to get reimbursed. But the kinds of ambitious librarians who are going are getting on secret award committees that are revealed later. And like they might be the person who, in a year or two, if you're developing a relationship with them, the publisher, if you're handing them that right book, that becomes a Newbery, that becomes Caldecott, that becomes a Outstanding Graphic Novel Award book, which is the hopefully soon to be announced Foley Award from the GNCRT roundtable. So they're establishing an award, as Heidi's reported about for many years, that's going to be coming to light. So like they have, and those lists become automatic buys for so many libraries. Booksellers use them, schools use them. It really can change the profile. And
No, I that was what I was getting at. It's like each of these librarians has a budget to buy books. And it's like, if you're trying to reach comics retailers, yes, sure, they're going to order a certain number of graphic novels. But each one of these librarians has potentially the buying power of a comic shop. And that is why people
Like
continue.
15 comic shops. They might be buying for like 100. Like if they're the New York Public Library's collection person, they might be buying for an entire city system or a school system. And then that school system is like becomes an annual adoption where every year for all of their classes, their senior classes, they're buying a whole nother set of 50, 100 books.
So, I mean, this is why we see a lot of participation. Boom was there, Oni was there, DC Comics was there. They just had their own booth. They weren't even part of like, there was no Lunar booth or
And small publishers, Rosarium was there. Then there were small publishers who maybe didn't have booths that were part of other exhibits.
I had an interesting conversation with I hope I get this right. SBC, which is a distributor, they distribute actually Silver Sprocket, who we'll be talking about later. They just picked up Storm King comics and also like some other, like Avery Hill, like some really eclectic. And I was talking
Thinking
to,
was there. They had a big booth.
yeah, they did. They did. And I was talking, but I was talking to one of the managers there, and he was just saying, this is, they've been inundated in all the diamond troubles, with people coming to them looking for distribution, and they have to be careful about it. But they're a strong player. They have a lot of experience selling graphic novels, and so they're like a lot of the players were there. There was, it was a great show. I mean, I love going to Philadelphia because, as you say, it's an hour train ride on the Acela. If it's farther afield, I think it's going to be in Chicago next year. I don't know if I'll be able to make it to Chicago, but I really love going to ALA.
Chicago, is the home city for
Yes,
ALA.
yes.
That tends to be their biggest conference. I don't know that I'll be there either next year. PW sends out a big group already. We have a librarian issues editor. I mean, I really got to go this year because of George Takei. Thank you,
Yes.
Sulu, Lieutenant Sulu. I want to say also that there was a sense that the librarians were really enjoying the time together because
Yes.
of the larger issues and threats. There was a sense of like solidarity and community. I got to spend a lot of time. I was so happy to with Casey Helwig, who was a fellow judge for me on the Eisner judges panel this year. And they have had a librarian for I don't know how many years. Heidi, you would probably know that they added a sort of spot for a librarian. And she is like lovely. She's a specialist in manga and kids and young adults. She buys kids and YA and manga for her library system in New York Public. Sorry, a New Orleans public library system. And just getting to kind of hang around with her and then her crew, they just were so happy to see each other. There were big hugs. You could just tell there was a really strong sense of solidarity.
Yes, absolutely. And I should mention that Publishers Weekly had a reception on Sunday night, and it was outside. I did learn that in Philadelphia during a heat wave, any place that has gardens in its name might be subject to the elements. We went to one place that was called Gardens, and we got rained on, and that was sort of an interesting experience because they didn't want to move us out of the rain. So, okay, Philadelphia, I see you. And this was under a tent, and it was a little sweaty, but it was a great turnout. I mean, it was really a nice event. I mean, it was really the only event where all the comics people were together that I attended, and it was, really just a great time to catch up with everybody and see a lot of familiar faces.
It
So
was
I
a lot of
really
fun. It was a sponsored event, so it was put together with Joe, our publisher, and some of the folks who've been sponsors at PW and bought ads, and they kind of brought together their books were on display. And PW has done a lot of call out for who the sponsors were. If you subscribe to their newsletters,
I'm not going to name them, but I
yeah,
know
they
they
did a lot.
included Mad Cave, Yen Press, Oni, a couple of other was there. Yeah, Boom Mwasa.
And then just lots of other people came. It was all about bringing the librarians in. And
Yes.
it was a little hot, but it was a lot of fun. It
It
was
was.
open
They
bar.
had frozen margaritas, so you were able to beat the heat
Yeah.
by
Steaks and
drinking
Island
them
cheesesteaks.
cold.
I was like, guys, there's no
Oh,
vegetarian food here.
yeah.
But
No, I know that was,
they're
yeah.
committed to being Philly proud. So there was like enormous overflowing cheesesteak pile, and people were like chowing down on those.
I mean, I will say, as a Pennsylvanian,
Yes.
cheesesteaks are summer food.
Yeah,
Oh.
thank you, Kate. They
It's
leaned into that.
not like I know it's like it's beef, it's cheese, it seems like a winter or fall food. It's not. Cheesesteaks are a summer food.
They knew
They're
what they were
like hot
doing.
dogs and hamburgers.
There was cheesesteaks aplenty. And there was also a reception for the JNCRT
Yes, we
for
should
their
mention that.
Eisner
Awesome.
grants for the libraries, and that was beautiful. And Heidi and I were both there as well. And folks were kind of coming back and forth between them. Oh, so can I tell this other story? Just like
Please.
a thing.
Yes.
Okay, so I stayed over two nights. I was in the Logan Square area, really nice hotel. As you all know from the podcast, I have young children, so it's also just like a secret joy. Not even secret. It's open secret. Everybody who like has to travel for work and has little kids is like, I get to sleep like once or twice a year. Like, I don't know, because my kids are like in, like I wake up, my little one comes in like every night and wakes me up. So I was really excited about that. And the first night I was just nervous because I was doing the big stage talk with George Takei, and I just like didn't, it's not like I slept well because I was like,
Yeah, I don't blame you. I would be sleepless as
I
well.
was stoked, right? And nervous. So then the next night I was like, we did this. It was a success. Librarians were weeping. And I like tucked in super early. Like I was gonna go hang out. Actually, Heidi, I think you and I were, I was gonna tell you what was up. And then I was like, what is up? So I'm going to bed. So I went to sleep early, 3:30 a.m. This like massive alarm went off through the entire hotel. I was on the fourth floor. They evacuated the hotel, and it's going like emergency, emergency, leave immediately. Do not take the elevator. You must take the stairs. And I like, thank God I grabbed my key because I don't know if I could have gotten in back in later. And I like threw on us what I'm wearing, like a nightdress essentially, which also thank God. So like it kind of looks like I'm wearing a long black dress. And I like throw something like a sweater on. And I go down these stairs. It was scary. Like you're going down these like concrete stairwells. And I knew, which is what it turned out
With
to be.
a lot of other people in their pajamas, by
Yeah,
the way.
absolutely.
I've been in one or two evacuations, and that, your fellow hotel guests in their sleepwear is sometimes the most disturbing part of it.
Yeah, and it's like an elderly people are trying to get down, and I'm like, thank God I actually know that George is not in this hotel because like I just was, and it's just like you've seen people with their kids, and I get down there, and I was also scared, like I will be real, because I knew about the concern around librarians. Like I was like, is this a bomb threat? Like I was,
Yeah.
and it was just that night I had seen that I had personally been like one of the people retweeted that they're like calling, it wasn't me, they're calling out to Kay, but it was still, I was scared. So I get all the way down there and it's like thick as like swimming in the heat and everyone's just like scared. And I walk out of the street and then I saw Elise Myers, who is a TikTok comedian who has two kids and does a lot of comedy around social anxiety. And I was like, I know this face because I see meals constantly. And it was like, we're next to each other. And she's looking at me. She's like, what are we supposed to do? And I was like, everything in me just like crisis mode was gone and like mom mode took over. And I was like, hey, I think we should go across the street. Like, we should go away from the building just in case there is a, like, let's go over here. And then I was like, I know who you are, by the way. Do you have a book? Are you here for ALA for your book? And like, I don't want to claim that like this, but she was like, oh, okay. And she like started talking about her book. And it was just, and by the way, which has pictures in it, I went back. She's being published by HarperCollins in the fall. And I went and got a galley, the next day. It has drawings in it. I wish there were more than 50% because then I could claim the territory and call it a comic, but it's gonna go in the memoirs category for my colleague. And it was also so, I didn't want to be creepy, but also like that's what I'm there to do is to discover authors' new books. And we like got to chat and I got to hear a little bit more about the book and how it came together. And like she also has little kids and she was just like, seriously. She was like, I'm so, she has an 18-month-old. So she was like, I was so excited to sleep one night.
How long was it before you could go back to your
We were
room?
out there at least a half hour, I
Oh,
think. And then also, we were in the back of the hotel. So, like, nobody came to tell us, like,
And
what
one of
was
those
going on.
beautiful garbage-filled alleyways,
Yeah.
probably.
And it's like, we just sort of, you like realize at some point, like, she was like showing me pictures of the art on her phone from the book, and we were just talking about like publishing and who her agent was, which was good. It was just good to like have something other than like, is this building about to blow up to be
Yes.
talking about? And then like we're like, oh, a wave of people is slowly walking to the front. And then they were like, yeah, we don't know what happened. And then you just like see the fire. They had like the axes. Anyways, it was wild. But it was a real silver lining because Elise Myers, I love your comedy, and it was lovely to talk to you. It was
Well,
real slumped. She's great. I don't know if you guys remember that she does the comedy about dating and like the guy who took her out and like bought 15 tacos. Anyways,
I do
she's gone
remember that.
viral many
Yeah.
a time. She's
Yeah.
lovely. She's very funny. And her
So
book is.
listen, Meg. From adversity comes friendship, but
I wish.
yeah, and I just one last quick thing, and then we got to let you go because we got a lot of other stuff to get to. But just I had dinner with the Difference Engine folk. You probably know them, right, from
Oh, yeah, I met
Singapore.
them also. Gina did a great job getting them in front of people at ALA, and they came in for us from Singapore.
So they are a publisher out of Singapore. And I hadn't actually seen their books, and I couldn't find their booth afterwards, but really some lovely, lovely stuff. I'd call it manga adjacent, really, but more kind of indie, autobio, some queer
It's more
themed
like
books.
literary comics, and they do a lot of weird stuff. They were part of the reason you probably couldn't find it was they were part of a larger publisher consortium display, but they are changing distributors, by the way. I don't know if they spoke to you about that. It's a little too early to say, but a lot of the books you might have been hearing about are going to move to the spring of 26 because they also were caught up in the diamond situation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of which, Meg, we're going to let you go so Kate and I can dig into the diamond situation if you're not tired of it, listeners. But
Thank you all.
oh, but
Listeners, there's much more to come. It's very different than the
yeah.
last thing we
Well,
complained about.
whoa, wait. And also, anyway, okay, Meg, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for hanging out in Philly, and more to come on that. Okay, well, Meg has left us, and me and Kate are here to cover the rest of the week, including the week in Diamond. So I know you're probably sick of this story. listening to it, so we're not going to go into deep dive. I will say I was a guest on Adam Freeman's Comic Industry Insiders podcast. We did a live stream on Tuesday, and if you go to YouTube and Comic Industry Insiders, you will find that where I go into a lot more depth about all of this. So, not to cheat, more to come, listeners, but there's just a lot else to talk about. So, I guess the biggest news over the last couple of weeks was pretty much a bombshell last week that in one of the filings, Diamond, and I differentiate New Diamond, which is the new company owned by Sparkle Pop, and Old Diamond, which is the Diamond that is under the bankruptcy court. Is run by Robert Gorin, who is the administrator of the bankruptcy. And then there's Ancient Diamond, which was before the bankruptcy. So I call them the three eras of Diamond. So this looks like it's kind of Old Diamond doing it. But basically, they announced their plans that they were going to sell all their inventory to raise money to pay off their debt to Chase banks and other secured creditors. And this includes all the inventory from publishers that was sent to them on consignment. Like,
Yeah, the stuff they
basically,
didn't actually own.
they don't actually own it, but they claim that because the publishers did not file an obscure UCC filing, which you needed to file when you first sent your consignment goods there. So this actually needed to be actually either in the very early days of the bankruptcy or else years ago, which turns out nobody filed it, or very few people filed it. That they claim they have the right to sell it under the bankruptcy laws. And I think it's fair to say that all hell broke loose when this was announced.
As it should.
Yeah, and Eric Reynolds of Fantagraphics did an interview with Rob Salkowitz on at ICV2, where he talked about this, and he essentially says his books are being held hostage. Now, the first inkling of this that we had was when publishers were trying to get their no cost returns, NCRs. Like, basically, if you're going to, Comic-Con and let's use Dynamite because, well, they don't actually set up, but let's say they're going to New York Comic-Con and they need 100 copies of The Boys to sell, because Derek Roberts is citing, they sent a little note to that'll order to Diamond and say, hey, we need 100 copies of The Boys, and Diamond ships them at no cost, which was actually a really good deal because they are handling this. So a few weeks ago, somebody sent in an NCR like you do, and they wrote back and said, I can't do that, Dave. Essentially said, oh, we can't handle, we've been advised by our legal team not to send out any more NCRs. So basically, Eric Reynolds is saying all their stock was held hostage. And so this is really bad on many, many, many fronts. First off, I don't think ever, I think a lot of people wrote off their debt to Diamond at the when they first announced bankruptcy, because that's kind of what happens. I do think that they probably thought that their books would continue to ship through whatever Diamond evolved into, and that they would not lose them and not have access to them. They lost their books. And some publishers are like, am I going to have to buy back my books on the cheap from Diamond that I actually own? And a couple of publishers like Dynamite, which was exclusive until very recently, like Diamond has all of their inventory. And this could be really bad for Dynamite. They announced that they are owed $1 million and they can't make payroll at this point. And they're in bad shape, or they're
Yeah.
at a real tight spot.
And it's not just that Diamond is like, oh, well, we'll sell them and give you the profits. Like, they aren't going to get the money from that.
No. The money is going to the banks. Which, I gotta say, there's, I look. This is, I hate to say it, but this is quite common in bankruptcies. Okay, a lot of the stock or the the inventory ends up not going back to people who thought they might have had the inventory. That said, starting on January 14th, Diamond, whatever entity was running Diamond, which I am made to understand was Raymond James and Robert Gorin, was like, hey, it's business as usual. Anytime anybody wrote to them, it's like, hey, we got this $40 million loan from Chase, so we're still shipping books. And indeed, from January until May, they did continue to ship books and they did continue to pay publishers. And however, if you look at the filing, you see that they were losing money and their value was decreasing. Their cash on hand was going down, and they actually had to go back and borrow more money from Chase. And so now, so it's a little bit of bait and switch, you know? Maybe it's stupidity. I'm not necessarily going to ascribe malice to it, but you know, it's just a very bad situation. And you know, creators really lose out as well, because this is like the entire inventory of graphic novels, some of them, right? And they're not going to get royalties on these books. And now they're going to flood the market with cheap remainder comics. I mean, it's very bad. It's a very, very bad. Another thing that happened this week was that Diamond shut down Comic Suite, which was their POS system. On this other podcast that I did, Brian Garside of Managed Comics came on. He says probably about 300 retailers still use this Diamond software, which isn't a huge number, but you know, we need every store. Luckily, Managed Comics is stepping in to help people transition. So, you know, it looks like there's a lifeboat for that. And then on a positive note, Universal, the Canadian distributor, excuse me, has begun selling DC Comics on their Alliance Games, otherwise known as Diamond Games, account, which we've said all along was their plan. Their plan was to buy Alliance Games, which was the games distributor, use their warehouse in Fort Wayne, Indiana, as their shipping hub for the United States, and begin to sell comics in the United States. So I think we're going to see more rollout of this, or you know, starting books go on sale in the fall. The new player is here. They're very quiet, probably because of legal entanglements. They can't actually say anything about this. Pardon me, sorry. And you know, I think competition is good. You know, we have Lunar. I mean, PRH is its own thing, but I think having Universal is probably going to be seen as a good for the industry, just in terms of, hey, you have options, you have choices. And by all accounts, they definitely know how to distribute things. So this could be a positive.
And I have to say, well, on one hand, competition may have accelerated the fall of Diamond. On the other hand, I think it was going to fall anyway, and I'm really glad there was competition there to pick up the slack.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. That's just a real, like, rough outline, because I don't think everybody wants to list all that. So the other big story of the week is really a hard one to report on, but the Comics Journal had a very long story called, the title was High Debts, High Rents, and Miscommunication: What Happened to Silver Sprocket? And we've talked about Silver Sprocket, the San Francisco-based publisher, on here many times. We have interviewed Avi Ehrlich, their publisher, many times. And it is a really fantastic, you know, company. And so, Kate, you had some thoughts about this. You know, this is a hard, it's just a hard story to read, because it's basically, you know, they have the beautiful, beautiful store on the Mission District of San Francisco. I've been there a few times. I've raved about it. It's one of the most beautiful shops I've ever been in. Guess what? Rents there are super duper high, and foot traffic's down. And you know, the main thing is that there was just a lot of confusion among the staff. There were layoffs. It was basically kind of like the company wasn't making as much money as it might have projected that it was making, and people became angered.
Well, there's more than that. People didn't get angry because it was making less money than projected.
Well, they were not being paid the
Yes.
royalties that they thought they were, and there was a
Right.
lot of confusion about what the royalty
And there
deal
was a lot of
was.
confusing as to what the word royalty actually meant. Which is actually a very important point where people were like, I thought we got royalties. And then they were like, oh, when we say royalties, we mean this different thing. And it was like, honestly, what I'm taking away from this is that, like, I believe everyone was well-intentioned. I just honestly think a lot of comic publishers and publishers, especially if they're trying to do something new and different, may not necessarily have a great grounding in just business 101, so that you know what the rules are before you break them.
Right.
Because sometimes the wheel doesn't need to be reinvented, and also sometimes ambitions just, run away with people. And unfortunately, this is something that's happened in comics before, and it's just really sad to see it happen to Silver Sprocket.
Well, I mean, we're saying it's sad. I mean, I do urge listeners to go read the story. It's very, very long, and I'm
Yes,
not going
read it.
to, yeah, to read that. And I haven't even really digested all of it yet, and I certainly don't have any opinions about, what the details are. I mean, Avi did come out and say that they were misquoted in the story, and that they were concerned about the slant of the story. And then one of the kind of I will say, harshest critics of Silver Sprocket also says that some of their comments were misconstrued a little. And then in the comments, there's kind of a, look, it's good reporting. There's enough good solid reporting here that we can see that there is just a lot of difficulties. Now, this doesn't mean that Silver Sprocket is going out of business necessarily, or that they're going away. I mean, I just feel like, there's been a lot of miscommunication on a lot of levels, and a lack of clarity. And because Silver Sprocket really presented itself as being part of this, punk rock ethos, and being very community driven, and priding itself on its transparency, that there's been even more blowback because of that.
But that's kind of ironic because, like, part of the whole punk rock thing is that you're flying by the seat of the pants and you don't think, you just do. And, like, unfortunately, when businesses are run in a genuinely punk rock way, sometimes disaster ensues, well-intentioned disaster.
Yeah, and I mean, like Silver Sprocket presented itself as this punk rock outfit who went to Comic-Con, and like set up at all the shows, and had this huge store, and had this kind of big infrastructure, and they've put out some of the best books of in recent years. I mean, we've just talked about them. Look, I guess what's hard about this is that Silver Sprocket is absolutely the upstart publisher that was really admired by us. We've talked about on the podcast, Meg Ca and Calvin, you and I, many times, by creators. If I went and talked to young creators at SVA and asked what publisher they wanted to be published by, they said Silver Sprocket. So they really presented themselves as, we've said it a million times on this podcast. How do you make a small fortune in comics? You start with a large fortune. And Silver Sprocket seemed to be the one that was bucking this trend by being successful and having the strong infrastructure while publishing really very, very niche indie comics. And, Carolyn Cash's Pee Pee Poo Poo being probably the best known and the best selling. And, there's a lot of creators online who have said they're pulling their books from Silver Sprocket. Others are standing by them. So, there's a lot of confusion in the community as well. So, it's just, I mean, there's more to come for sure on this story, but it's a little, I would say I feel just a little disillusioned, and saddened. Just sad for Avi, for all the creators, for everybody
Right.
got laid off, for everybody.
Yeah, it's sad for Avi. It's sad for the publisher as a whole. And it's sad for everyone who worked with them, who, you don't make a lot of money in comics. But when you feel like you should have made a little more, it can hurt all the more.
Well, there's sure to be more to come on this story, as we mentioned, and we might do a deeper dive on it in the future. Okay, well, the other big news of the week was the passing of Jim Shooter, former Marvel editor-in-chief. He passed away on Monday after a battle with esophageal cancer. He was age 73. He was the editor-in-chief of Marvel. Now, I don't have the exact dates. I believe in 1978 he was made editor-in-chief at the age of 27, a very, very young age. And but he had broken into comics at the age of 13 when he sent off his
14.
first. Well, okay, here's the thing. He was 13 when he sent off the story. Okay. It was 14 when it was published. So
Got it.
that's why there's a little differentiation. But we could say 14. I mean, 13, 14. He was a child.
Yes.
He was a very tall child. He was 6 foot 7. That was the other, defining characteristic of Jim Shooter. But anyway, and then he was but
Apparently, he made his first business trip to New York with his mom.
Yes. And he was under the tutelage of the editor, Mort Weisinger, who apparently was a pretty horrible taskmaster for anybody, let alone a teenage, an underage teen. And it was perhaps some of that led to some of the later controversies. I
Right.
will.
I think that there's a very old school management technique.
Yeah.
Learned young a real long time ago that, maybe was not always ideal compared to other management techniques, even while he did a lot in comics and was a really great creator.
Well, I mean, listen, I was a huge fan. I wrote a little piece about remembering Jim Shooter. I was a huge fan of his writing. I just loved it. I was a teenager myself and I loved his run on Avengers. I thought the characterization was just fascinating. I just found the characters so glamorous and yet powerful and super duper loved it. Now, as editor in chief, I will say this. Now that a couple of days have passed, I'm not one of those people who, unless it's Henry Kissinger, the day that they die, out of respect for their family, you don't immediately lead with the headline, hated head editor in chief dies, right? So there was a lot of reminiscences that reference Shooter being a controversial figure or a polarizing figure, but very much, emphasizing the positive. And for the last 25 years of his life, like Shooter really made a living being, I mean, I'm sure he had a little bit of work, but he went to conventions, he was always at the con. He was at Heroes Con, I believe, the week before he died when he was suffering from, the late stage cancer. And, he was constantly hanging out. Everybody has stories about hanging out with him in the bar and listening to his stories. And so, I that was kind of the second act of his life, or the third or fourth act. I mean, I will say, I think an examination of his time at editor in chief is called for with a balanced eye, because he did some absolutely great things, like introducing creator royalties. He introduced graphic novels. He pushed material for the direct market. He was really, really innovative that way. Also introduced Frank Miller, Bill Sienkiewicz. Bill Sienkiewicz just put up on Facebook that he owed his career to Jim Shooter. Walt Simonson's run on Thor, like a lot of really great comics. That said, he wasn't that great with LGBTQIA themes. Like, he literally banned having gay characters in Marvel Comics at the time. And there's some other issues about maybe how some of the female creators and characters were treated during this time. Which is of the time. I'm not saying he was so horrible. It was very much of the time what he was saying, of his actions. But he wasn't really he wasn't a trailblazer in those regards at all. And also, look, he was hated. Like, when he was fired as editor in chief, like after 9 years, like, creators were celebrating because he had driven away an awful lot of people, because he was very, very much an autocrat. Of as an editor in chief. And
I think it's not unreasonable to say that someone was flawed as an editor and great as a writer.
or just complicated. Look,
Yeah,
it's not
complication
history
happens.
isn't black and white all the time, and I'd say Jim Shooter definitely is in the gray area. There was a lot of things that he did during the time that were very controversial. I am happy that he found peace, that he found people made peace with him, and he was able to enjoy the community at cons and with fans and everything. So, it was that part of it was definitely, everyone spoke very well of their interactions with him. He was unfailingly polite and generous with his time with his fans and fellow creators. So
Yeah, I mean,
Well, rest in peace, Jim Shooter. He's truly left his mark on the world. All right. Well, the week in AI, Kate. What's going on there?
so to return to a topic that has been all the rage, sometimes literally, in manga and anime over the last year and a half. AI, more specifically, AI translations. Now, some smaller publishers have been very open about, like, we're going to use AI at translations. It's something we're going to try. But Crunchyroll was very firm on, we're not using AI on our subtitles. We're not even thinking about using AI on our subtitles. No AI on our subtitles.
They took a stand.
They did. Dear
Uh-oh.
reader, people smelled a rat. More specifically, they smelled real bad subtitles. So, basically, Yuzuki Family's four sons had subtitles in German that made no sense. And also, Necronomico and the Cosmic Horror on June, that she came out on June 1st, also had similar issues. And people
Uh-oh.
were like, these subtitles, they are bad. And then one of the subtitles, and there's a screenshot of it, says, ChatGPT said, "When ich die Welt von hier ad wieder genießen kann."
Ah, ich deinen Berliner.
Ich bin ein AI. Oh dear.
Oh, snap. How did the
And so
community
it's
re how did the com
badly. Badly. They responded badly. And the statement of, like, we're not even thinking about using AI was only 2 months ago. It's not like,
Wow.
oh, we did this a year ago, we changed our idea, like, we just forgot to tell you. No, it was 2 months ago. And one fan, RPG hacker on Blue Sky said, and this is a great quote, "Man, this is so embarrassing. Even using ChatGPT correctly was too much effort for them."
Wow. Ouch. Yeah.
So Crunchyroll is laying low. They have pulled the offending episodes. We'll see.
Look, we all use little AI helpers. I've used Otter AI to do my transcripts for years and years and years. And the reason why it ends in AI is because it's AI. And that's fine. But I go over it. A human being goes over the transcript and fixes it and corrects it, And so, I understand. This happened with Google Translate in the past. People have been using Google Translate for translations and then not fixing it, And they hired what I think they're localizers or whatever. Like they've hired people to go in and fix the dialogue on manga. This happened in the early 2000s where they were using translation tools and then hiring humans to clean it up. But this is nothing new, but boy, you got to cover your tracks better, bud.
People have said that the subtitles are so bad that they're
Oh man.
almost unwatchable
Yeah.
for the show. So, like, maybe this was their pilot couple shows that they were like trying it on. It's and also, like, typically, if you are not just machine translating the transcript of the original episode in RAW, you are buying Crunchyroll for $8 a month.
Right.
You are paying, and they were saying they were offering professional translations of the things you're watching, right? Like, if that's what you say you're selling, you should sell that. And there are real translators who can do that. And like, honestly, transparency is important.
Well, there's undoubtedly more to come on that. But finally, a story that I hope there's not more to come, because that would be really bad. Apparently, some things are happening in Japan based on Japanese tourism, meh.
Oh, that backwards. Okay, so based on a manga that proclaimed to be a prophecy of bad things that were going to happen in the future, people are not visiting Japan during like a couple week period that is prophesied to have a major earthquake. Yes. That's right. This time people are not just taking their stupid prophecies from gurus or from, rumors on TikTok. They are taking it from in manga. And this is a big enough deal. These are big enough numbers that Reuters are cover is covering this.
Oh, wow.
Japan Times is covering this. Like, this is a significant number of tourists. So the book is called The Future I Saw, and it's created by manga creator Ryo Tatsuki. His sales ban the sales banner his publisher's using to market it is, "Whether you believe it or not is up to you." And so it has been. Japan's had like this is not like it's a bad year for Japan. April had an all-time monthly high of 3.9 million travelers. Like, people are going to Japan. People are specifically not going to Japan in July of 2025. And so arrivals from Hong Kong and China are down 11% year on year. Apparently, like this, and that's like a big source of tourism in Japan because, obviously it's nearby. It's a nearby country. Of course, they're going to get a lot of travelers from there. But not this July because people are taking this like prophecy, and it is being very much in the book, like written that way, even though her publisher has released a statement saying she's not a prophet.
Wow. I mean, this is human nature. You remember the year 2000, there was this, or 2012, there was this idea that this Mayan prophecy was going to say that the world was going to end, and there was a little bit of doomerism then. Obviously Y2K doomerism, and Nostradamus, the most famous prognosticator, has, there have been actual panics based on his prophecies as well. So but now it's a manga, so
So like airlines from Hong Kong are canceling flight to Japan during July. One in specific is Greater Bay Airlines is canceling their Hong Kong to Japan flights, which is usually a significant run. The latest edition appears to predict a catastrophic event that would occur specifically on July 5th, 2025. The mangaka is saying, "Well, I'm not specifically predicting that specific day."
Wow. Well, listen, we'll know by the time we record our next episode. You will know whether this came about or not. So, all right. Well, I think that about wraps it up. And this has been the most troubled recording ever, just because we ha I'm sorry, I had so many interruptions.
So I have a quick promo for you
Yes.
listeners, because it'll probably be gone from the newsstands by the time we record again. But Marvel Comics is doing something unusual, something they haven't done in like 20 years. And to promote and piggyback off of the upcoming Fantastic Four First Steps movie, they are bringing out a Fantastic Four bookazine, which is sort of a book dash magazine with both a graphic novel length amount of comic in it, including a new retelling of the origins of the origins of the Fantastic Four by Alex Ross, a comic by Mark Waid and Mike Maringo, a comic by Jonathan Hickman and D.L. Eaglesham, and a comic by Ryan North and Eben Coelho, plus a code for $30 in free comics online. And this is going to be sold at like grocery stores and Walmart and stuff. So keep an eye out. It's a good bargain if you
Well,
want to like start stuff.
hey, they just said if you could only get the comics back on the newsstands, it would save comics. So, here's your chance, people. Here's your chance. Marvel's going to follow up on that and put this comic back on Walmart and on the newsstand. So, comics are saved.
They're saved. They're saved.
Hooray! All right. Well, on that note, guess what? There will be more
To
come.
come.
I don't mean to harsh mellow, but how do you pronounce your last name, Meg?
Oh, Lemke.
Okay, that's what I thought. All right, there was a little controversy over that. So my bad.
Really?
Well, it's okay. Don't worry about it. I'll tell you later. This is human nature. You remember the year 2000? There was this, or 2012. There was this idea that this Mayan prophecy was going to say that the world was going to end, and there was a little bit of doomerism then. Obviously, Y2K. Doomerism. And Nostradamus, the most famous prognosticator, there have been actual panics based on his prophecies as well. So but now it's a manga, so
Yeah.
yeah.
So like airlines from Hong Kong are canceling flight to Japan
Wow.
during July.
Wow.
One in specific is Greater Bay Airlines is canceling their Hong Kong to Japan flights, which is usually a significant run. The latest edition appears to predict a catastrophic event that would occur specifically on July 5th, 2025. The mangaka is saying, well, I'm not specifically predicting that specific day. Yeah.
Wow. Well, listen, we'll know by the time we record our next episode, you will know
Yeah.
whether this came about or not. So, all right. Well, I think that about wraps it up. And this has been the most troubled recording ever, just because I'm sorry, I had so many interruptions.
So I have a quick promo for you
Yes.
listeners, because it'll probably be gone from the newsstands by the time we record again. But Marvel Comics is doing something unusual, something they haven't done in like 20 years. And to promote and piggyback off of the upcoming Fantastic Four First Steps movie, they are bringing out a Fantastic Four bookazine, which is sort of a book dash magazine, with both a graphic novel length amount of comic in it, including a new retelling of the origins of the origins of the Fantastic Four by Alex Ross, a comic by Mark Waid and Mike Maringo, a comic by Jonathan Hickman and D.L. Eaglesham, and a comic by Ryan North and Eben Coelho, plus a code for $30 in free comics online. And this is going to be sold at like grocery stores and Walmart and stuff. So keep an eye out. It's a good bargain if you
Well,
want to like start stuff.
hey, they just said if you could only get the comics back on the newsstands, it would save comics. So, here's your chance, people. Here's your chance. Marvel's going to follow up on that and put this comic back on Walmart and on the newsstand. So, comics are saved.
They're saved. They're saved.
Hooray! All right. Well, on that note, guess what? There will be more
to
come. I don't mean to harsh a mellow, but how do you pronounce your last name, Meg?
Oh, Lemke.
Okay, that's what I thought. All right, there was a little controversy over that. So
really?
Well, it's okay. Don't worry about it. I'll tell you later.